But do your best Dreadnought gang sign, Tim.
No, I don't do gang signs.
We're gonna talk about comics from Devil's Due. It's something you wondered if Talking Joe would ever do. I guess we'll explain it all to you. Gonna take some time to read the books we've never read. Oh, oh.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and you are listening to Talking Joe, the G.I. Joe comics podcast. Now, if you are new to the show, you can find out all about us over at our website. Our website is talkingjoe.co.uk. If you've not visited yet, well, you know, go on, head on over and see all of the stuff that we have got there. Now, today is not a party political broadcast for the Talking Joe website. We will actually be talking about the disavowed era of G.I. Joe from Devil's Due with the comic G.I. Joe Dreadnoughts Declassified issues 1-3, which came out in January through to May 2006. It was also collected in a trade paperback called Dreadnoughts Declassified, which came out in 2007. Now, talking to me about this comic will be two people. And first of all, it is a real American biker gang leader. It is Tim Finn.
Hello, Mark, and hello, listeners. And I guess this is where I make some Dreadnoughts reference. So, how come we gotta plug up this hole?
Thank you, Tim. Now, we are being joined today by a very special guest who is an expert on all things Dreadnought, I'm going to say. Certainly, he's a fan of them. It is Ryan Sweeney, aka Dreadnought Ryan, aka the Island of Misfit Toy Collectors. And
I hope everyone gets to enjoy Ryan. Their grape soda and chocolate donuts as we get to talk one of the best comics that I think are out there, because it's all about the favorite sub team I have, the Dreadnoughts. Thank you, gentlemen, for having me on today.
It's
Ryan,
our pleasure.
From where are you transmitting?
I am transmitting from the beautiful Burton, Michigan, in the United States, of course.
And do you have some toy or Dreadnought things around you? What is this room?
Of course I do. And the Cold Slither Zartan custom that I did. And then back, as you can see back there, I have a swamp dio set up for my Dreadnoughts as well, too. I have the prison that Zartan is kept in because, you know, the Joes are just, they know it's better to put him behind bars than let him out into freedom. So, yes, absolutely adore the Dreadnoughts. And, of course, it's Cold Slither time, as always.
And then another question. So, longtime listeners, viewers may know that Mark was reading the Devil's Due comics when they were published. I started them and bailed out pretty quickly. I came back once or twice. Did you read them at the time? Had you read the Marvel run? Presumably, you're not reading Dreadnoughts Declassified for the first time for this episode, as I did.
I actually, when it moved from Marvel, or when Devil's Due picked it up, I dropped out. Without having Larry in there, that was my kind of like the breaking point. I'm like, without Larry, it's not G.I. Joe. I did go back, though, to Devil's Due, and I went through and read the series. And, of course, I picked up my Dreadnoughts. And I actually fell in love with a lot of the writing from the Devil's Due. I liked how they made all of the Joe Carrier characters a little bit more gritty. And you saw more flaws in the Joe Carriers, like Duke, for example, Flint. And then, of course, I really like what they did with the Dreadnoughts as well. So I did go back after the fact and purchase a lot of the Devil's Due stuff. I am a big fan of it as well. And I kind of got over that hang up where it's got to be Larry who writes these stories. And I think that opened my eyes to a bigger world of G.I. Joe with a lot of talented writers and artists who could come in and just add to the lore a little bit more.
So that sort of segues probably into what our first question often is, which is, do you want to tell us about your G.I. Joe origin story? So where were you? How old were you when you first encountered?
So I was 6 years old in 1982 when the commercials hit, and I was an instantaneous fan. I had been a collector, you know, Star Wars, like I think all kids were at that time. But my big thing was like Super Friends. I love the Kenner Super Friends figures. But when I saw G.I. Joe and they weren't superheroes, they were real people, that really appealed to me. And then, of course, when I found the comics, which I didn't find the comics till after the cartoon had started, I was just a little bit too young. We had this comic shop by my grandparents' house and they would let me walk up there. And I found the G.I. Joe comics and I'm like, this is crazy. And I just remember I started picking up issues of them, and then it may help me fall more in love with the characters. And then, of course, when Zartan came out and the Swamp's gear and the gimmick that he had, so the color change, that's what really kind of brought me into, I want to have that figure, Mom. And I remember bargaining with her in a Kresge in Michigan, which it's a five and dime. It was like an offshoot of Kmart at the time, you know, to get this particular figure. And then I read the file card on the back and he had more depth than a lot of the other G.I. Joe or Cobra characters. And I was hooked on the Dreadnoks from that point on. Of course, when Zorana and Xandar and, of course, you know, Ripper, Torch and Buzzer came out, and then Monkey Wrench. And, you know, I was just a Dreadnok for life from that point on. So that's my Joe origin stories. I've been in love with G.I. Joe since 1982. Just an amazing toy line. Larry added so much depth to all of the characters. He changed them from that two-dimensional to the three-dimensional. And I think that's what separated the G.I. Joe toy line, comics, and cartoons from all of the other brands that were out there at the time.
And how long have you had the handle?
As soon as I started signing up for social media, I knew that was going to be my handle, because it's been Dreadnoks, you know, for life. I've always been attracted to the Dreadnoks. I still have my 3¾-inch figures. The only ones that survived was Zartan, because he was so special to me, you know, as you get older. But the Dreadnoks were always awesome to me. That Mad Max feel, the Outcast, I think for a lot of kids growing up in the 80s and the 90s, you had that feeling of being an outcast a lot of times. And that's what always kind of always brought me back to going, you know, like, I'm a Dreadnok. I know I am.
Have you read the continuation from the Marvel run? Have you read all the IDW comics?
Yes, I did. Love the IDW. I have to say that I have to blame G.I. Joeberg for really getting me all back into everything. Steve and Paul and Rob, you know, talking about it made me think about it more. I found out IDW would picked up and brought Larry back. So I'm like, well, I've got to pick up those comics. And then I started to see all the different sub story arcs that they had underneath it. The Chuckles run, I think, was one of the best comic runs that they did for story arcs, and then rolling into Cobra Island. But yeah, I bought digital copies of pretty much all the IDW stuff that I could get my hands on. And now with Skybound, I've picked up those and I'm enjoying those as well too. So.
Right. And can you tell us a little bit about the Island of Misfit Toy Collectors, your YouTube channel? What's kind of your MO for what you do?
It really started out with me and a friend of mine, Fixer, where we just wanted to talk about our toys and you know, 80s stuff. And, you know, unfortunately, life gets in the way sometimes. And he's like, hey, bud, I just don't have the time. And I'm like, that's fine. We have a lot of folks in the community who are absolutely amazing. You know, I talked about G.I. Joeberg. You have Hooded Cobra Commander 788, Chris McLeod over at the Full Force. You know, just tons of great people who have been so welcoming and open to people to, you know, reach out to them, talk to them. And for my channel, I wanted to keep it more of a, I don't want to say like fanboy, but it's going to be more positive than it is going to be negative. I think there's just so much negativity now in the community, in the world, that your comics, your toys, your cartoons, those are just a way that you can escape from everyday life. Enjoy them for, you know, an hour, maybe, whatever it is. And I want it to be an honest place for folks to go and just have real conversations. right now, if you're a G.I. Joe fan, my humble opinion, it's one of the best times to be a Joe fan. We have more product than we've ever had. We have comics again. Larry Hama made it to 300 for the Joe line, which is awesome. It's moved to Skybound. I think we're going to see, you know, a new story told for G.I. Joe, which is probably what we need. Then, of course, for action figures, if you're an O-ring collector, Super 7 just announced that they're going to start putting out O-rings. Hiya Toys is doing the modern style. Of course, you have the Classified. You have Mezco. You have the Ultimates. It's just a great day to be a Joe fan. You know, Assembly Required, Joe Fest, some really great conventions out there where us Joe fans can go to and visit with other Joe fans and just have a good old time.
It's all true. And listening to some of your stuff, one of your catchphrases seems to be like, you know, when people are complaining about these, you know, hunks of plastic, you're like, it's just a toy. You know, it's meant to be fun. It's meant to bring us, you know, enjoyment. If you're getting angry and upset, you're probably toying wrong, aren't you?
I look at, if I'm, you know, 8 or 10 year old Ryan, and I see this Zartan on the shelf in my local store, my mind is blown. Just the detail. I mean, when we had the O-ring figures, they were amazing, but they didn't have a lot of detail. The vehicles were great, but they were undersized a lot of times. We didn't care. And that's when it's fun. Mm-hmm. Toys are about creativity. If you do dios, if you do figure photography, you're using your imagination. It's the magic of what toys are. Comics, you go into a world, it gets your creativity going. You start thinking, man, that's a great backstory. What if they added this, that, or the other? And then you just kind of get your headcanon going crazy. That's what makes it so enjoyable. The magic is your creativity, your imagination. You do all those different things. It makes the hobby enjoyable. And if you look at guys like, you know, Mark and Ben from Skeletron, they had the imagination to create that amazing Robo Skull. You look at, you know, Lenny from the Classified team and Tony, and you see what kind of figures they're putting out and the little details they're adding in there. And then, of course, you know, all the folks who are creating these new O-rings, Delta 17, mm-hmm. of course, Carson, and then Call Sign Longbow. All amazing new stories to tell that you can continue in your G.I. Joe world. It's, you know, why fret over, well, you know, the paint app's wrong on this. I who cares? It's a toy. It's a toy. Go have fun with it. Go take pictures. Go outside and play in the snow if you live in someplace that's cold. Go outside and play in your pool. You know, you might be a 40-year-old adult, but you're just having fun, and that's what it's all about. Sorry, I'll get off my soapbox.
Let's talk comics.
Yes.
Okay, so today we are talking about Dreadnoughts Declassified. So creative team, and this is going to be a fairly long list. Writer Josh Blaylock returning to G.I. Joe. Writing pencils, Corey Zazatz. That's a good name to have, a Z name. Joe Dodd, Robert Q. Atkins. Inks from Jeremy Freeman, Clayton Brown, John Lowe, Pat Quinn, and Rich Zajac. Another Z name. Who'd have got? What a synchronicity. Colors from Rob Ruffalo, Gary Henderson, James Lewis, Peter Sofranas, Chris Summers. Letters, Brian J. Crowley. Senior editor, Mike O'Sullivan. Assists from Timothy Straub, and front cover from Clement Suave and Stephanie Peru.
I think that's Stefan Peru.
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
Okay, so this is a 3-issue miniseries, and Clement Suave covers 1A, 2A, and 3A all connect. We see this really killer, moody portrait of just Zartan holding up his cool pistol in the cover to number one. And then in the cover to number two, a little bit to the right, there are four of the Dreadnoughts, and there's just a great variety of body language. Some are close, some are far. And we're in the swamp. And then the cover to issue 3, we've got 3 more dreadnoughts. We've got a bunch of cool negative space in the background, giving the idea of swampy trees and the Thunder Machine. What's so great about Clement Sauve's art is that he is drawing different body types and facial types for all these characters. And he's cartooning and he's caricaturing just a little bit. So, you know, Road Pig in the cover to 2 has a really big sort of big chin, big forehead, big cheeks. But, you know, Buzzer's got a really skinny chin, for example. So I had never thought that the characters might look like this, but I did not read this miniseries when it came out. I was intrigued by it, but I think I'd been sort of now burned by sort of what Snake Eyes Declassified was and some of the other Devils Due stuff. So I thought, oh, these covers are great. And then I flipped through the books and I thought, okay, I don't think this is for me. The B covers, Francis Manapul, who we're going to sort of quote meet again in a future episode when he does the covers to G.I. Joe Declassified. Cover to 1 is Zartan and his brother and sister in the swamp. This is different than the A covers because it's pencils only. And Francis Manapul is one of a handful of artists around 2006 who I would accept pencils only from, because he's doing some rendering, or there's just sort of like enough of a balance between the sort of blackest black of the dark pencils, which is not that black, and the color structure. Manapul's cover for 2 is Torch and Buzzer and Ripper causing some mayhem. Interestingly, at the bottom of that cover, it says Prestige Collector's Edition, whereas it didn't say that on the cover to Manapul's variant for 1. And it says it again on Manapul's cover to the issue 3 variant, which is Zartan fighting Zartan with a dramatic sort of color burst of light behind them as they're grappling with each other. And again, it says Prestige Collector's Edition on the bottom. And I wanted to ask Mark, who knows many things comics, and as well as our esteemed guest, since I don't have these B covers in hand, were they bound differently? Were they printed as like perfect bound prestige format editions, or were they just sort of regular stapled comics with a fancy name on them?
That's right. So is the A cover, you've got that in hand, right? Is that just a normal floppy?
Yes, but I don't have the B cover.
Yeah, so I believe that the B covers are prestige bound and also at a different price point. I think the A covers were $4.99, and I think the B covers were like $10.99.
Oh, okay, yes. Yes, I'm seeing, okay, cover price for 3 issue. Yeah, $4.99. Cover price for issue 3 is $5.50.
Yeah.
Whereas the cover prices for the variants are $9.95, $9.50, and $9.50.
Quite a premium, isn't it, for the extra fanciness of the binding?
You know, I mean, DC Comics has been doing something like this, I say this in 2023, for the last couple of years, where A covers for like regular Batman and Action Comics and Suicide Squad are, you know, $3.99 or $4.99. And then the B covers are printed on a thicker cardstock and they're a dollar more, but it's otherwise the same comic. Mm. I wonder if it's doubling in price for Devil's Due, is this a subtle way to sort of fund the company and this special miniseries? You know, you release a deluxe product and then you hike up the price. I don't say this cynically. I just sort of am inquiring, if you hike up the price extra, you know, if the series doesn't sell a lot, it pays for itself, or maybe you can keep the lights on a little extra. And, you know, because you didn't force people to buy the regular one at the higher price, it's really only the enthusiasts who are buying the not just more expensive, but much more expensive one.
And I'm saying, ooh, an extra $5, that sounds expensive. But, you know, flash forward to today and the variant covers that we see, you know, never mind $10, you know, think of all of the rest as well. I succumbed and I actually bought my first ever variant cover. I bought the Carson Thorne variant to 301. That's the Dawn and Snake Eyes foil variant without the logo, and plunged a whole £20 into that one.
But technically, there's a difference here, because all these variants, all these ratio variants that are coming out from Marvel and IDW and DC and Skybound and Image, they are technically still the normal cover price. It's the retailers who are on day one hiking up the price because they either can or feel they need to. Whereas, these Dreadnought comics day one are either normal price for a double size comic or a normal price for a fancy double size comic, but they weren't rare or artificially rare.
Mm. I wanted to point out a cool thing from the Francis Manapul variant for number one, which was this cool sort of skull type dreadnought silhouette that is created by the shadows of the three siblings on the swamp water. A nice little subtle effect there.
Also, his initials are mapped onto the surface of the swamp water, both in perspective and also according to the rippled texture of the water. Manapul has turned into not just a good comics artist, but an excellent designer in his page layout. And if you have read his Flash run, which he co-plotted and drew with writer Brian Bussolato, which was the first 3 years of the DC New 52, particularly his title pages. Manapul did some really clever and inventive and pretty and exciting panel and page layout. And so this looks ahead to that kind of thing. I wanted to say one more thing about the cover to issue number one. It does not feature creator credits. And maybe that's because there are several names on the inside and that gets cumbersome or embarrassing on the cover, but it does have these two striking words on the bottom right corner in a distressed font: Blaylock Returns. And no Devil's Due cover had done this, had hyped the writer of any of these comics in this way. And I think if you're a Blaylock fan, this would really excite you. I think Blaylock earned this for, getting the license and pulling the book together, writing the book, getting everyone else to do the books and take over the books. And he had, now been identified as someone who did interesting stuff with the Dreadnoughts, like Zanya and Zartan's age and illness in the earlier Devil's Due issues. Mm-hmm. So this is a cool thing. It's also just really unusual because you compare it to the whole Marvel run, which didn't have cover credits, but that wasn't the norm at Marvel at the time. And even the IDW run, both Larry Hama and Nan after, I don't know that a writer has ever been called out like this on the cover to any G.I. Joe cover, right? It's not like when IDW picked up the Marvel continuity with the Free Comic Book Day or 156, it said like, this is it. Hama's back, or the Skybound issue. It's in all the press releases. It's in the interviews. If you're a Blaylock fan, you might think, cool, yes. And if you're not a Blaylock fan or you don't know who Blaylock is, you might think, huh?
And that was me when I came back when I picked these up, because I had to do a little bit more research on, who Josh Blaylock was. And that was part of it. So I agree with you, Tim.
And yeah, like you say as well, it makes sense that he's the guy reading this, because he's clearly got an affection and an affinity, because under Blaylock's era of writing the book, there was a lot of focus on the Dreadnought. I think a good chunk of issue one was focused on the Dreadnoughts. I think the base was in Florida and he'd established that it was, in the absence between the end of the Marvel run and the new issue one, that the Dreadnoughts had become this sort of countrywide force with chapters in every state and grown in the meantime. And featured them across quite a lot of his issues, and obviously introduced Zanya as a new character as well. So I think more than almost any other writer apart from, you know, Hammer, I think he's the guy who's focused on the Dreadnoughts probably the most. And I added in an image of the back cover of the trade paperback as well, because I thought it was interesting seeing that, because obviously they've picked out some promo press there to feature on the back of the cover. They say, one of the most compelling and mysterious stories in G.I. Joe lore finally laid bare. And if you love G.I. Joe, this is what you've come for, and more. So you know, must have been some good press at the time in reaction to this. I did find the image of the final cover as well, which was a web store exclusive, which featured the Devil's Due designed Dreadnoughts logo, which is essentially a skull in kind of the Zartan's cowl on a sort of brown background, which sort of featured a fair amount in those I think early issues from Devil's Due. I quite liked it. Dreadnought Ryan, what was I won't say Dreadnought Ryan each time. What was your thoughts on this particular logo?
So this is one of the logos that I use a lot for some of my custom stuff. I think it's great. I think that was one thing that was probably missing from the Dreadnoughts for a while, is some sort of either, you know, mascot type thing, or just to have the logo that separates them away from Cobra. And I think this is just absolutely an amazing choice to use.
I wanted to just tip my hat to whichever designer at Devil's Due created the Dreadnoughts logo type, the actual letters that we see on these covers, because I think that's a cool logo. In the scale of really, really easy to read and impossible to read, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 through 5 being like safe and 5 and 6 being like slightly getting into the danger zone, I think it might be a 5. But that said, you know, the letters are uneven. They're sharp and jagged. They taper. It sort of, I don't know, evokes sharp things and blades and, you know, shifting, you know, Zartan's always shifting and changing. Maybe even the tops of the letters being in sort of a wave shape, you know, alludes to the water in a swamp. I don't know, but I have always liked this logo and I think it looks good on these comics. And I'm gonna transition slightly here, because I think Mark's about to get to a plot breakdown. Mark, can you remind us all what else is in the trade paperback collection of this miniseries? And can you give us maybe the sentence reminder of what that is in plot?
Sure. So the trade paperback for this collected edition includes the 3 issues, but then also as a backup story, they reprint America's Elite issues 5 and 6. Well, not the whole issue, the backup story that was in there that we had a whole episode talking about. And that was a story called The Past Comes Back. And this was a story exploring Zartan's past and I guess his sort of troubled mental state, and looking back to his past, trying to get some photos back from when he was young to kind of help anchor him and stop him from, I guess, losing the sense of who he is from all of these identities that he's established. And there's a little bit of crossover with this three-part issue, because it kind of fills in the blanks as to why Zartan runs away, you know, some of the circumstances around Zartan running away from this orphanage.
And just remind us that the backup story with Zartan from America's Elite is not collected in any of the regular America's Elite collections. It's held back for this Dreadnoughts Declassified collection.
I believe so, yeah.
Okay. You got a plot breakdown?
Kidokie. This was quite a tricky plot breakdown. So we'll see how brief I can keep it. And there's, I think there's some words in here and names which are bound to trip me up. So, Bo, bear with me. Okay, here we go.
Plot breakdown.
A young Zartan, along with his siblings Zachary and Zoe, are made orphans when his father Zeke and mother Melanie, are blown up by a car bomb over some unpaid debts. They go to an orphanage. Zartan runs away while his siblings are adopted and moved to London. After a couple of years doing petty crimes, Zartan enlists in the military and takes up a new name, Luke McKinney. 5 years later, under the name Ormery Sanderson, he teams up with a Dr. Blinkinsmythe, who later becomes Buzzer, to steal some secrets on Project Chameleon, a genetic experimentation project. And they travel to Australia, where Buzzer joins a biker gang called the Dreadnoks, and Zartan, who's not called Zartan, betrays Rusnian gangsters to sell Destro the government secrets. Zartan, who is now calling himself Zartan, is recruited by Cobra Commander to kill Snake Eyes, a mission in which he fails, and we know all about from the details of the original books and also Snake Eyes Declassified. Later, he is tracked down by the Rusnians that he betrayed, and he is put through a French genetic procedure called Project Chameleon. Following this, he has new powers of invisibility, which allows him to escape, but out in the daylight, the sun hurts his skin, turning him blue. Buzzer shows up, saying that he wants Ormery to take over as the leader of the Dreadnoks, replacing the real Zartan. Ormery, Ripper, Buzzer team up with Torch from the rival Melbourne Maulers gang, and they stage an attack so that he can pretend to stay there to save the day and join the gang. His siblings Zoe and Zachary have also joined because they were following leads to try and find their brother. The real Zartan, the original Zartan, this is, finds out about Ormery's plotting and is about to have him executed when Zachary and Zoe save the day with the help of Torch and the Mauler gang. Zartan has taken on his new identity as the old Zartan when he is contacted by Cobra Commander, who wants him to come over to the States for them to work together. To be continued in the pages of A Real American Hero back in the early 1980s.
Part of why there's so much to cram in your plot breakdown, even though we've described this as a three-issue miniseries, these are all double-sized. So this is six issues worth of comics.
That makes more sense now, Tim. So it's a lot of story, and there's a lot of flashing forward and backwards, which makes it slightly harder to do a linear plot breakdown. So before we get into things, sometimes I like to have a pause and make sure we're staying positive, and we say something nice. So let's do that right now by saying something nice, a couple of observations about what we liked about the book.
Well, I done read a heck of a lot of comics. Some of them are great, the team are all on it, but some are a bit cack. They really are whack. Before the nitpicks come out, I'm giving it my bestest, and nothing's gonna stop me from trying to be positive. So I'll pause my scorn to put up two thumbs and turn my frown upside down. Take advice, it cannot wait. Say something nice.
As our guest, why don't you start with what you most liked about this series?
I liked how, with Blaylock, he tied in stuff that Larry had added through the Real American Hero run. He expanded some of the Dreadnought characters, so you had a little bit better understanding of where they were coming from. And I like the craziness, if you will, of how the story was so disjointed, because you were, like you were saying, we were moving forward and backwards. It's like he was telling the story from, you know, being in Zartan's mind and having the mental issues he had. This is how I would envision Zartan telling the story. So I thought they did a great job of staying in the Zartan character and developing other characters as well.
I really like that observation that maybe the fractured storytelling is kind of slightly related to Zartan's own state of mind, that maybe it's a little bit less linear and a little bit less easy to follow.
You know, at the end of the third episode, when he's fighting the real Zartan, and he says, I blamed others for all of this, and I need to start taking responsibility, or something to that effect of like, you know, I can't blame other people for everything that I did. It was me. And that's where I just kind of see him telling the story and, you know, everything that he went through, and he did a ton of evil stuff through all of this. You know, you can't get past the fact of, you know, he killed a kid while he was a kid, and he robbed and he stole and he did all of this horrible stuff. And he always tried to blame somebody else for it, when he had to finally admit to himself that he liked it and he knows who he is now. And I just thought, you know, Josh Blaylock did an amazing job in that aspect of the story. I will add that I am very easygoing person when it comes to comics or stories. I give them a chance, and if it's something that intrigues me, I'm all in on it.
Tim, do you want to go next? What was something you found positive about this story or these comics?
There is a line in issue 2, it's on page 27, where Destro's father, Destro, is talking to Destro, James, and he's describing Cobra Commander, who they haven't quite named yet, and he says that he, Cobra Commander, understands that we're now in an age where information, not industry, is primary, and he's collecting so much of it, and this is to be sort of marveled at, and also we can now do business with him, or we can now do more business with him. And I thought that was a really smart and new take on something that has maybe always been there, or we've always been near it. But I also, not a lot of other stuff about this three issues in story or art jumped out at me as like favorite and awesome and incredible. So in picking out something positive besides the really cool covers, I am zooming in on, you know, two bits of dialogue from one page from one issue. I'm casting a pretty narrow net here.
I think my big positive is probably the covers. I think the work from Clement Suave is amongst the very best from Devil's Due, and I think it's probably quite possibly the best ever image of the Dreadnoughts as a team, and yeah, is definitely hard to beat. I think that's a real high point. I'll sort of expand beyond the covers as well, because we sort of talked about that before, but also, you know, I'll give my hats off to Josh Blaylock for trying to, you know, pull as much as together of the various sort of seeds that have been sort of scattered around. Is that the right metaphor? But all of the various pieces of the kind of Dreadnought jigsaw, let's say, that have been sort of scattered around since the launch of the G.I. Joe brand. So there's like, you know, the elements of the Zartan story from the Marvel comics, that kind of a recapped. There's picking up from you know, the file cards about some of the details about, you know, Torch's background in you know, the Melbourne gangs and Buzz's background as kind of an academic in England and that kind of thing. So and also sort of drawing in other, you know, other little nuggets which are probably harder to even spot. For example, hinting at the origins of Zanya, which I'll touch on later if we don't get to before. So
I'll say one more thing, nice, which I think thematically, which you just covered thematically, which is, I think Blaylock is the person to do this. Mm. And in the broadest of strokes, I think Josh Blaylock writing a Dreadnoks and Zartan origin is a cool idea. I'm all for it and I want to read it. And so where this miniseries doesn't wow me, I think of it as sort of a noble failure. You know, it's like, well, I mean, Blaylock was the guy to do this. I love that they made a whole series of declassified miniseries and specials that they were filling in these gaps. And I think they were like allowed to and right to try. And I think if I had sat down to write something like this, I would have started with sort of similar, you know, territory, like, okay, well, kids are like, oh, right, he's got two siblings, or, okay, well, these are the points that are covered in his file card. How can I expand those? How can I connect those? You know, like, oh, there's some prehistory with Destro. Like, that's cool. And there's, you know, how do you tie this in with the Cobra Commander origin and the Snake Eyes origin? So in theory, I like all of this. And I'm, you know, particularly under these radical covers, these rad covers, like, yes, I'm like ready to sit down and enjoy it. And then here's where I turn. Then I open up to the inside front cover and I see a bunch of names for pencil ink color. And I don't recognize any of them. And so I think, oh, right, Devil's Due at this point, you know, they're 5 years in. Sales, you know, they had to relaunch the book. They're concerned about sales. They're cutting costs a little bit. You know, the third issue isn't inked. It's just colored straight from pencils. And, you know, I think the artists are all not quite good enough to pull this off. Like, you know, the nuances of, you know, facial expressions and panel compositions and acting and action, and just the fact that there's so many people and the styles are all like pretty similar, but like I noticed a real big change in the color from issue 2 to issue 3. Issue 2 looks like sort of normal, but very murky, dark computer coloring. And then the coloring by someone else in issue 3 looks like it's all marker, which is actually kind of cool and a nice fit for that art. But, you know, this thing, it's like, okay, one writer, the guy who should do this. It's like, imagine if one of the artists who we like from the sort of quote regular issues of the Devil's Due comic had drawn this and all of this. You know, it's like, oh, we've solved some of the problems because it's just, you know, leveled up.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, both you and I, Tim, are quite art centric, and that will often be the thing that we get drawn to first. You know, more so than perhaps the story or the characters. You know, other people will be, you know, sort of less focused on the art, or maybe just the fact that their favorite character is in the story is enough that this is going to be their favorite book, no matter what else. But sort of just looking at the creative team that you've got across the book, you've got three main pencils and then also art assist credit. You've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 inkers across two issues, and as you say, issue three doesn't have an inker at all, and you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 credited colorists. You know, that sort of points to maybe some trouble behind the scenes. I mean, maybe it, you know, maybe some of the artists couldn't deliver, or maybe the deadline pressures just got too much, and they sort of had to divvy these things. But it often does point to just somewhat of a troubled behind the scenes process when you do have multiple creators being credited like this.
I know I'm it's the Dreadnoughts and I love this, but I will add that when you completed issue 2 and then you went to issue 3, it felt like the story was rushed. Mm. And I know that these were double issues, so 48 pages for each, which you do get 6. But if Devil's Due had dedicated, 6 issues to Snake Eyes, 7 issues to Storm Shadow, that's one character. You're talking the Dreadnoughts. I think my only pushback on the story is there was so much. It was rushed through. It could have helped with a little bit more development in the story. I almost think that you needed another issue. There should have been a number 4 to split issue 3 into a 2-part to finish the complete story.
Yeah, it didn't read as it read as crowded and complicated for the first 2 issues, but not too crowded and not too complicated. In issue 3, halfway in, I thought, oh, suddenly there's this, I know we're suddenly talking about the end of the miniseries, and we haven't really started about issue 1. So we'll get to issue 3, I guess, later, but I will agree with Ryan here that issue 3 really wants to be 2 issues, whether it's a double-sized 4th issue or whatever.
And it's called Dreadnoughts Declassified, but it's mostly Zartan Declassified, with touching on elements of the other aspects of Dreadnoughts, because, you know, the likes of, let's say, Naugahyde gets a couple of panels. I think Zanzibar might get a single panel. Thrasher is an Easter egg panel, which I hadn't even realized until I looked in the back matter, and it's pointed out that he appears. So you know, they're trying to cram in all of the Dreadnoughts there, and I think they do get all of the main Dreadnoughts in on at least a panel a piece. But you know, with a panel a piece, you can't necessarily have two rounded out a story arc for each one of those Dreadnoughts.
This is a pretty noodly point, fellas. Tell me what you think. So the characters are introduced in toy order in the world of the toys. You know, Zartan comes first, then the 3, and then Monkey Wrench and Thrasher, and then, you know, Xandar and Zarana, and then, you know, Naugahyde or Zanzibar's in there. But and this series follows that to some extent, but I've always thought that the toy release order should suggest the sort of time that people meet or are introduced. And so when I see a story like this, I really want Torch, Buzzer, and Ripper to show up first, and they mostly do. But if Zanzibar or Naugahyde shows up sort of before or more than Monkey Wrench, something about my, you know, little kid collector who's thinking of, like, you know, as a kid, I didn't line up my toys in like wave 1, wave 2, wave 3 order, but I was aware of it. And I've always thought that, like, no, in the story of G.I. Joe, Zartan meets and recruits Naugahyde later, you know, unless like Naugahyde's file card says that, like, Naugahyde knew Zartan from before. And this might be just way too sort of finicky or seemingly random. And, you know, like, organic things happen where it's like, no, Chuckles shows up in 1987. There's no reason why he's like, why he would hang out with the Joes. But G.I. Joe Declassified, the 3-issue miniseries, has Chuckles show up for a panel or two before the events of G.I. Joe issue 1. And I thought, cool.
I don't know if I'm the only one that thought that Chuckles showed up for a brief period in Dreadnoughts Declassified issue 3.
Oh, yeah. Just me? Well, also, I forget what issue it was. Was it him? There's a blonde guy with short blonde hair and sunglasses and a blue shirt. Yeah, and I thought, oh, it's Snake Eyes.
Right.
Or, you know, Matt Murdock. So... And there is one random person. There's one panel in, I think, issue 2. There's a random person with, like, short. Oh, it's when he releases the gas and he escapes from the facility, and a bunch of people are choking around him. The other prisoners are test subjects, and one of them has short red hair. And I thought, hey, it's Zarana. Like, nope. No, because the story has established that she has pink hair so far, but maybe we haven't seen her in like a flashback or two. And, you know, I go back to this thing, this point that I've made on the show before, where if in a G.I. Joe story, you have an attractive Caucasian woman with glasses and long black hair, I'm going to assume that's the Baroness and or Chameleon. And, you know, in any X-Men comic, if you have a bald Caucasian guy without glasses and with no facial hair, that's Charles Xavier. If he has glasses, it's Cornelius from Weapon X, I guess. And and it's like it, that sounds like so limiting. Like, sorry, for the rest of history, writers and artists making Marvel stories, you can't have bald Caucasian guys. It's like, no, you can't. You have set up this iconography, and if you do, it better be about some imposter or disguise or something. Anyway, okay. Well, I wanted to point out something that I thought was really clever in issue one, which is that Blaylock names Zartan's brother, right? Before he's Xandar, he's Zachary. And I think Zarana doesn't get named until issue two. She's Zoe. Yeah. So here's a fun little bit, right? They have Z names from birth. That's fun. Zartan is never named. In this story, we don't actually hear anyone speak. We don't see it written down, his actual birth name. When his parents are talking to him or about him to each other in the first issue, before he takes on his first assumed name, they don't use a name. They're like, you know, I can't help you, or go outside and play, or, you know, talk to your mother, like, leave me alone, go talk to your mother, or take your siblings outside. And I thought that was a nice understated thing that thematically follows.
Yeah, because I found it hard in that plot breakdown to know what to call Zartan. You probably picked up on that, you know, because his name, it keeps on changing. And then there's also this other Zartan, the real Zartan, who assumes his, next Zartan, or whatever I want to call him, the Zartan we know, that picks up his identity. I found that quite hard to sort of piece together, to try and make that a sensible plot breakdown, referring to Zartan while he's not necessarily Zartan.
I was going to say, I agree. I struggled with Zach and Zoe for Xandar and Zarana. I get the Z name, but I think at the end, he's like, well, you guys need to pick new names for, you know, for your new identities. And it's like, wow, they stayed in the same Z and just, you know, I don't know. I would have liked to see more, I don't want to say normal names, but since they're from Florida in this story arc, it just seems like it would have been like, you know, Sarah and, you know, Joseph, or, you know, something like that, more pedestrian type names. But I understand where Blaylock was coming from.
I want to pick on a thing I like in the art and storytelling in issue one, and a thing that I don't. In the scene in the house with the family, I think it's clever that Zartan's dad works in makeup and practical effects. And I think that it's clever that his mom is an actor, or a want-to-be actor. So there's a good thing. And there's some nice details with the way their house looks on the outside and the inside. Both period details and maybe also stylistic details. You know, there's a wall that's red paint or wallpaper. There's an arch inside. There's a lava lamp. You know, there are palm trees. You know, pretty good. On page, I think it's 15 or 16, excuse me, page 10. There's a bad guy in a car with a radio spying on the family, and whoever is talking to him on the other side is like, kill them. And the guy on the scene looking out from his car says, he is Zartan's dad. He's not going to pay. And I saw him arm himself from the window. Right. And I'm thinking, Well, you're way down the street. I really need to see you holding a pair of binoculars because you're too far away. Like, no, there's a window in that panel. There's a window on the house and it is tiny and it's all the way on the right side. And that's just a small thing.
Can I talk about this page as well? There was something that really quite annoyed me about this page, which is that this is the page with the car explosion where Zartan's parents die. And we know that because, you know, following this, it picks up. The story is that the following page, 2 years later, they're in an orphanage. And but this car explosion, yeah, so it kills his dad because he's getting into the car and that's what, you know, and it blows up as he's getting inside. But the last we see of the mother, she's stood in the doorway of the house quite some distance away from the car as it's blowing up. And actually the kids who are playing, as they shout, "Mum, Dad," in the garden, seem to be much closer to the explosion than that we saw from the mother. So there was a little bit of them missing establishing that the mum was close enough to that explosion to be caught up in it.
Yeah, what we need in that middle panel on the right side of the radio that the bad guy is holding, where we can see three weird little white silhouettes of the kids, that should be like the mom going closer to the car, if nothing else, if not like something more significantly redrawn.
Can I talk about page one, panel one, which is kind of got me off to a little bit of a bad footing on this story. I complained a little, I mean, I don't know, complain's a strong word, but I grumbled a little bit about Scarlet's Declassified when we spoke about that last time, and that I felt like the flashback nature and the flashback within a flashback within a flashback nature of that story just made it slightly harder to follow, and definitely the flashback element to this story made it much harder for me to follow and track who I was following and when and how it fitted into the rest of the context of the story. And it was I pretty much had to read this three times to really get it properly straight in my head, and I think I've enjoyed it more on each reread because the plot made more sense to me, because on initial read it just felt a little bit too hard to understand what was going on. But anyway, Panel one, it says, "This story takes place before G.I. Joe issue one." And I thought to myself, okay, I think you mean issue one of A Real American Hero from 1982. So before G.I. Joe started, but you as Devil's Due have just very recently published a comic called G.I. Joe issue one in 2001, which was the restated arc. So they're kind of setting themselves up for confusion straight away. And then after saying this story takes place before G.I. Joe issue one, presumably before 1982 in publishing terms, it then says, "Now, hold on, don't have it both ways. What is it, 2023, 2024, or 2006, or 1980 or something?" that word "now" made me think, oh.
Yeah, another comparison to Scarlet Declassified, where the first page and the last page use some photos for the backgrounds, which I thought worked for Phil Noto, and he doesn't do it at any other point in the book except for the first page and the last or second to last page. This first panel on this first page of Dreadnoughts Declassified number one is very clearly traced from a photo or very carefully referenced from a photo, and you're allowed to do that. That is a fair workaround. That's a fair cheat in comics. Lots of great and lots of not great artists have done and do that. But it doesn't feel like, for me, it's sort of a confident first step where I see the Las Vegas sign and I think, cool. And then it's like the blobs of color and space in the background, I think, oh yeah, this is a trace of a photo. And then I look down at the next two panels and I think, okay, this guy can draw pretty well. these poses are like 60% of the way there. You know, like I understand what's happening, but they're not elegant. There aren't good rhythms to these poses. And I immediately wonder on page one, panel two, is that Zartan? And I think sort of the fundamental question of this miniseries is, when we're looking at someone, is that Zartan?
Yes.
And I don't mean like Blaylock is playing with sort of him losing himself in his identity, which I like. I mean, which character has the artist drawn, and are they being identified clearly? And Zartan changes his appearance over time, I think, you know, four or five times in this miniseries. And when it's present day, when it's the Marvel issues or the modern Devil's Due issues, the then contemporary modern Devil's Due issues, Zartan has a costume. And I think, well, there's Zartan. Here I see a guy with a ponytail and a leather jacket, and I see two, I don't know, like Las Vegas bouncers or like tough guy mobster bodyguards. And I think, I bet one of these three people is Zartan. And then later, there's a quick scene that I think is a slight retelling of something from G.I. Joe 26, Marvel 26, or G.I. Joe Marvel 84. And we see Zartan in a costume that like Larry Hama or I think Marshall Rogers has drawn him in. And, you know, he's got different hair color and different hair length. And at that point, I got mixed up. I thought, wait, is this Buzzer?
Right.
Oh, wait, no, we've seen in continuity, we've seen Zartan before with like sort of blonde hair, a light brown hair. And one of the risks, and there are lots of risks. One of the risks of telling a story of your character before they're the character with the cool gun, the cool costume, the cool makeup, the cool vehicle is who am I looking at? You know, it's like,
yeah. And that was, I think, another thing that probably wasn't the strength of this issue, or rather the series, is that when the characters were in costume, in a recognizable costume, and, you know, they're well-designed, sort of generally Ron Rudat designed costume, you'd be like, that's the character. I know who that character is. There's no, you know, confusion there. And that costume looks cool. And it's like the toy that I used to have. And I say, that's fun. When there was a character that wasn't based on a toy, it was less cool, because not just because it wasn't a toy, but because generally they were just a little bit underdesigned. It'd be like a guy in a suit, a guy in a leather jacket, a guy in a t-shirt and a short-sleeved jacket. You know, it was less, you know, visually exciting. Even with the dreadnoughts, if it wasn't a toy-based dreadnought, it would typically be a guy in a leather jacket or something like this. There wasn't a lot of design flair to the way that a lot of these characters were looked.
So, okay, I try to be positive 99% of the time, but if you go back to the first page, that Las Vegas skyline is not from the 1980s.
Oh, no.
It's from modern day. And if you look at the outfits that these characters have, these are not 80s style outfits. So I get that you want to set when the story happens, but if you're going to do that, it's the little detail stuff that's so important. And since this is 82, we're just coming out of the 70s. So, you know, a lot of the fashion style hasn't changed too much. The other issue that I run into is his parents are both in the entertainment industry, and yet they're living in Florida. So I'm just going, okay, it's Disney, right? But I'm thinking, why wouldn't that be set in Los Angeles? If his dad is doing prop work and his mom is an actress, why is that not set in LA?
Or there's just one bit of dialogue that refers to, like, we got to get to LA where the industry is, or like, honey, I'm working on this tiny indie film, you know, I'm working on this cable TV movie shooting, you know, at the theme park here. we got to get to the big city.
Just looking at that sculpture, I think he might be sculpting Globulus's face there. Sorry.
Okay, so I want to, Ryan, may I take the mic back, or do you have more to
That's
say
cool.
here?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so thematically, all right, so a moment ago I said there are some risks to telling this kind of story, and one of them is like art clarity with the artists that you do have who are, you know, not great or only okay, when a lot of the characters are not in sort of their exciting costumes that we know. Another one is, does this story want to be told? And forgive me if I've paraphrased this Patton Oswalt stand-up comedy before, because we talked about origins or sort of between the gaps stories getting filled in. But there's this Patton Oswalt stand-up from, I don't know, 2005. He's talking about the Star Wars prequels, and he says, he's sort of playing two characters here. Oh, do you know Darth Vader? Oh, Darth Vader, Dark Lord of the Sith. He's the most feared villain in the galaxy. Do you want to know where he comes from? Oh my goodness, I get to hear about Darth Vader's background in these new Star Wars movies? Yes. Well, he's a sad little boy. and the audience laughs. And then Patton Oswalt continues like, oh, okay. Well, I don't know if I wanted to, do you know Boba Fett? Boba Fett, the most feared bounty hunter in the galaxy? Why, yeah, he's such a cool character that did so much with so little in Empire and Jedi. Do you want to learn his origin? Boba Fett's origin? Tell me. Well, he's an angry, lonely little boy. I don't know if I wanted to. So, okay, so let me come back to Tim talking about G.I. Joe. I love all the flashback stuff in the Marvel run, you know, where Cobra Commander gets an origin and Zartan gets an origin and Snake Eyes gets an origin. And I have always wanted more of that. And when Hama has told more of it, I've never been disappointed. I will note that some of the early and middle stuff are like more exciting, maybe because I was younger, and now that I'm older, you know, maybe I don't need that stuff as much. Like, Mark, what's the issue? Is it 286 with the like one more flashback to the LERP group in Vietnam where Snake Eyes speaks? And yep.
Right.
Okay. 286, IDW 286. Storm Shadow's on the cover kicking in his white costume, even though it's all a flashback to Vietnam. And I thought that issue was great. And I had someone read it who said, yeah, it was good. I don't think it covered any new ground that we hadn't seen, or that we hadn't seen sort of better in previous flashbacks to Vietnam. And I thought, huh. Okay, so we get this big expansive story for where Zartan came from. And I think in the biggest top-down view, I think so much of the excitement of Zartan is the mystery that we only get a few sentences on that toy package and a couple scenes in the Marvel comics. And if you're going to tell us A, everything, and B, some of it is like kind of sad or sort of exciting, but like not the most exciting, you know, like the scene when he's on the private jet, is it the end of issue one, right? He's been captured by the Rusnians. You know, like two of them sort of looked like Tomax and Zaymod, and the end of the issue, like the final panel of issue one of this miniseries, is this not very dramatic cliffhanger where Zartan is like sort of tied up and he's got his arms behind his back and I think he's holding the knife, and one of the bad guys is like, don't move, and it's like, to be continued. Like, what? Okay, it's like, no, I want like the plane about to crash, or you know, the bad guy like pulls the stewardess over and it's like, this is your mother, I'm gonna kill her, like surrender your weapon. So let me make one more analogy. Wolverine from 1975 or 1974 until 2001 2002, only a little bit of his origin was known, a little bit of his backstory. A lot of it was in doubt, and it was all sort of scraps, right? And he didn't remember. And some of it was faked. So the writers had this ongoing device to make up new stuff and add more question marks. Larry Hama. And with that miniseries, which was just called Origin, which is now reprinted as Wolverine Origin, we got his origin. And he's a sad, angry little kid. He's a little boy, and he's got little claws that come out of his hands. And and that was a prestige. You know, that wasn't Dreadnoughts Declassified. That was a prestige Marvel book. They had one of their top artists on it. They had their like top color artists doing like digital painting on top of pencils. It had three writers, one of whom was like a kind of top writer for Marvel. And as a story, I like it. As a Wolverine story, I don't really like it. And I don't really recommend it at my store. But I do appreciate that the editor-in-chief's explanation for why Marvel Comics told that story was because if they didn't, Hollywood would. And so they wanted to do it on their own terms. And I think that's a getting forced into doing something is a good reason to do something. But I think back to, and then if I can continue my Wolverine analogy for just a minute longer, sometime around then in the House of M miniseries, there's a like a timeline shift. There's a reality shift. And when things come back to normal, Wolverine remembers everything. And there's this left page turn, full page splash of Wolverine like waking up in a grass field with a stunned look on his face. And he says, I remember it all. And I thought that moment was really powerful. And that was going to allow writers to tell really interesting stories to us about what had happened. And then Wolverine in the present day reckoning with what had happened, like taking down old villains or teaming up with, you know, people he had teamed up with before, but hadn't known, you know, like cool MacGuffins and props. And then they immediately like start a new monthly series for a writer whose work I didn't care for, who for 3 years told that kind of story. And I didn't read that book. And so on balance, looking back at all these years of Wolverine stories, is Wolverine less exciting and interesting because he knows everything and we know everything? Maybe. You know, like there's a magic to the late 70s and 80s and 90s when he didn't know and we didn't know, or we just knew bits. And again, I think Blaylock is allowed to tell this story. And I think there's some interesting plot bits in this story, but I find a lot of it not as exciting as just a cool Zartan story. And I think that might be sort of more so than like the art or it's like, well, he's a kid. I don't care about like a scared kid, or like, well, don't make this about a sad, scared kid. Make this about like a cool, terrible, evil villain. I think I would have rathered three double-sized issues with just some really badass Zartan story. And maybe it could be a flashback to some mission before G.I. Joe number one. And maybe it could have some elements of Cobra Commander, Destro, Snake Eyes, the Hardmaster from before. But I don't know that I need every gap filled in.
I agree. I absolutely agree. I think with the Devil's Due run, there were a lot of great ideas and there was a ton of goodwill for what they wanted to do. It's the execution, trying to get through too many stories without letting them really just be told. If you're going to tell that sad kid story, tie it into what everything that happened to him in his childhood made him into the person that he is today. And I think that's kind of some of the pieces that are missing from this particular story. I'm going to compare this to like if you're looking at the MCU versus DC. So you had Justice League for DC. They try to tell too big of a story in too short of a time. And that's how this really feels for the Dreadnoughts. Where if you're looking at the MCU, they told the story over more movies because it allowed you to develop those characters and understand why they are doing the things that they do. And I like this story, and I'm a huge Dreadnought fan, and I think that's a lot of it. But there's just so much you could have done telling the story if they would have slowed down and then started building on it like they should have. But I think, Tim, like you said, and Mark as well, this was around that time when things weren't going good for Devil's Due. So they're just trying to see if something hits and they can, you know, help keep it going. And I think it did a disservice to some of these characters that we love.
Yeah, I think you've both hit on something, you know, really key to this story, which is that I think by trying to do everything –
in terms of that origin of childhood through to, you know, close to Zartan's first, you know, canon appearance. It's just trying to cover and then sort of bring in alongside that all of the Dreadnoughts and you know, chuck in some other characters like Tomax and Zaymot and Destro at the same time. It just sort of ends up being a bit of a join the dots rather than feeling like a kind of a satisfying story just in its own right. There's the new story, but it's sort of trying to anchor it to these, let's hit this milestone and this milestone and this milestone. And I think the flashback nature of it makes that just feel more fractured as well and harder to follow, which takes some of the fun out of it, because you can't just turn your brain off to some degree and just read it as a story. You're constantly trying to have to reframe, okay, and where am I and who's that guy at the same time.
Here's one more analogy. There's the Adam McKay directed movie produced by Judd Apatow, Anchorman, with Will Ferrell. Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, where he plays a dumb newscaster in the 70s. And there's so much outtake footage because of that Judd Apatow style of making comedies where the actors riff and riff and improv and improv. You have so many takes and so many long takes. And there's so many extra scenes. An entire second movie. I don't mean the sequel. I don't mean Anchorman 2. I mean an entire companion movie was released straight to DVD the same year, at the end of the year that the first movie came out. It's called Wake Up Ron Burgundy. And I watched it and it's pretty funny. There are a lot of funny scenes. It doesn't fully make sense unless you have seen Anchorman and seen it recently, because it still hinges on the like really basic plot of the first movie, which is that he's the number one news guy. And then this other person shows up and he feels threatened. And then at the end, they have a resolution and they're these like kooky supporting characters. And if you were to give the DVD to Wake Up Ron Burgundy, this like middle movie, to someone who hadn't seen the first movie, I don't know that they would find it satisfying. And here's a metric I sometimes use, and I forget about when I'm thinking about G.I. Joe, because I assume only G.I. Joe fans are reading G.I. Joe stories, and like non-G.I. Joe fans definitely aren't. And like casual fans had better remember the highlights, or like buyer beware. If you have a friend who reads a lot of comics and they haven't read G.I. Joe, and you handed them Dreadnoughts Declassified, and let's pretend that like the art was all by one person, and you know, some of the faces were more distinct and the costumes were a little bit plussed, and maybe even with this magic wand, the like flashback, flash forward stuff was a little bit clearer. If we're just talking about all the writing that Blaylock does here with this, to use Mark's term, connect the dots, right? With some references to like G.I. Joe 26 and G.I. Joe 84. If you handed just this to someone, and maybe they only knew Zartan from like the cartoon, could they follow it? Would they like it? And I think this might be Wake Up Ron Burgundy.
I think I have to, if you've watched, ever watched Park and Rec, I have to quote Ron Swanson. Don't half but two things, whole but one thing. And if you're going to do the Dreadnoughts, then you have to tell the Dreadnoughts story. If it's a Zartan story, then it should just be all Zartan. So I agree with you on the aspect of I looked at it as this is Zartan thinking back and his disjointed mind, because he does have the mental illness, the schizophrenia, whatever you want to call it, that was listed on the initial file card. But that might have been me just being very forgiving, because it's Zartan and it's Dreadnoughts, and I've been wanting the story for so long. Maybe it is looking at it the more critical eye and saying, I get where you're coming from, but if you'd have just added a little bit more in explaining stuff, it would help tie the story together so much better. Like, you know, I've struggled with this my whole life. You just get little hints that he needs to be on medication from other people saying, oh, are you on your meds? Or he never says, like, at least I think this is what happened. And I think if somebody is really dealing with those type of mental issues, they would be saying those things.
I'll go back to something positive. There's a lot of plotting in issue one that I think is really effective. Like the scene where young Zartan is playing Dungeons and Dragons with his friend, and he's at his friend's house and he tells a lie and distracts his friend. And then there's a wordless page where he just raids the fridge. He takes a six pack of Coke or maybe four cans from a six pack and some Wonder Bread and an apple and an orange and something else and something else. And then he sees his friend's mom's purse, and sticking out of her purse is her wallet. That's great. This is a great page. And it's not too on the nose. Like there's a moment in issue two when the Rusnians are talking, like the main Rusnian bad guy says, you know, I think this is a scene where he says, how was I fooled? We have to track him down. This man who betrayed us. I can't believe I hired someone whose real name I didn't even know. And his number two says, I'm not sure that psycho even knows his real name. And I thought, oh yeah, like the file card where, you know, Zartan loses his, what's the line in the file card? It's like the original personality's lost. And then I thought, I don't think the like number two would say that back to his boss. I feel like that's a little bit of Blaylock saying it to us and like nudging us in the side with his elbow, like, I got the thing. I checked that box. And there were two or three times when something felt sort of too on the nose. And I thought, this is being explained a little too plainly, or it's being explained when it shouldn't be spelled out at all. It should just be shown, or like, oh, let's just skip this little bit. And then, you know, we get to this thing we referred to before, to issue three, where I think it's page 25 or like pages 29 and 30. I think I'm counting correctly. I might not be, where all of a sudden there's like a montage and there's just like a bunch of sort of flashback where our Zartan is ingratiating himself with the real Zartan with this plot to like take over and I guess maybe kill him. And that's when, for me, it might've happened a little earlier for Ryan, when for me, I thought, oh, this definitely was going to be a 4-issue miniseries that got mushed into a 3-issue miniseries, or, you know, Blaylock plotted a story and then like came up with something better and had to make it longer, but couldn't.
The thing that struck me about this particular page was that out of nowhere comes caption boxes. I don't think they'd been used at all, or certainly not to this degree, up to this point. And suddenly, out of nowhere, we've got Zartan narrating in these sort of grey caption boxes, covering the events of the montage. And it, as you know, maybe it's just out of sheer necessity. How do we cover a whole bunch of story in a shorter span of time because we're running out of pages and we're getting to the end? Let's have a montage and cover it with words.
Yeah, and who is he talking to with these captions? Ryan, you had something to say.
You said he was checking boxes as Blaylock's writing this. That's exactly what it was. I think that's what's kind of always, that's the missing element for me. That when you just said that, I'm like, everything I thought was cool. It's just him like, oh, see, I talked about schizophrenia. I talked about this. I talked about that. Here we go, you know. And it was just checking the boxes as a wink and a nod to the Joe fans from past issues that were either in the Marvel run or the cartoon or whatever it is. And again, this particular page here, you know, he's talking about how he's integrated himself to being Zartan's number two. And it's like, I'm going to pick on Snake Eyes the movie. Part of the problem with the movie for Snake Eyes was you can't take that origin story and shorten it just to get to the ending. They did that with this particular part. And we've already said that this should have probably been another issue. Him building that rapport with the real Zartan should have been the one issue. And then the final issue is the betrayal. It just seems like, it's just, it's half baked story. And if Josh Blalock wouldn't have spent so much time checking the boxes and just writing a good story, this could have been so much better. I really think it would have helped Devils do a lot more if they would have had more clarity in the story that they're trying to tell.
This reminds me in some ways of Reinstated, the first four issues of the Devils Do G.I. Joe, where that series started after a long time without G.I. Joe. And you had the sense that things had happened in the interim, you know, the Joes have gotten new jobs or they've gotten families, Cobra Commander's gone somewhere, Cobra's reconstituting. This is a little different because there are sort of flashbacks and forwards in this, or flashbacks and more flashbacks. But in the way that that first arc, there's a lot that happens. And when we did that episode of Talking Joe, sometimes I was counting how many panels are in a page. And, you know, like at their sort of most basic average comics, I think have 6 panels per page, might depend on the decade. But, you know, if you have a story that wants to breathe more, really fancy art, you have fewer. If you have a denser story or you want to tell a different kind of story, you might have more. Or it might depend on the scene. But something that Blalock does when he writes G.I. Joe is he has a lot happen, which I think all other things being equal is a good thing. And a lot happens in Reinstated, and he's juggling a lot of characters. And that happens again here, where you've got Zartan, his siblings, all the other Dreadnoks, all the other Dreadnoks who aren't the ones who got toys. What's the other team here called? Is it the Maulers?
Yeah, the Melbourne Maulers.
Okay, the other biker gang. And it's an interesting twist where Torch is from that group and he gets sort of pulled in. I don't think I liked that, but I thought it was an interesting take and you know, a decent idea.
It's a nod to his file card. It calls out that he was originally in the Melbourne Maulers.
Okay. Well, I look at me, not doing my research.
No, but Tim, that goes back to checking a box again. So he's their inside man in the Melbourne Maulers, but how was Torch their inside man? Where, how was that connection made? Who, that's what was missing for me in that third issue is there were a lot of questions that weren't answered. Mm-hmm. And while I loved the story because it made me start to add more to it in my headcanon for Zartan, there was a lot of important pieces that should have been added to help tell the story that it wasn't. And I think that I'm critiquing a comic book artist who put his story out there, and I'm sure that he did the best that he could, but maybe it was too big of a story to take on. I think you're right, Tim, when let's just make this a really cool Zartan story and do it as a declassified missions or something from his adult into when he starts working from Cobra. And I think that would have been a great story, but I think this is too big of a story to only tell in 3 issues. It could have been 8 or 9 issues.
And when we read the backup story from America's Elite, The Past Comes Back, which is in the back of this trade paperback, we both actually quite enjoyed that. It had, interesting sort of painterly art, but also I think the story from that was much more focused. It was more of a sort of story unto itself rather than trying to, you know, create a big span of history. And while it did incorporate flashbacks, those were a lot, you know, more focused on a particular period or scene and more integrated into the wider story. So there was a you know, very distinct short piece of, you know, a couple of days of worth of story and an encounter between the Zartan, the Dreadnoks and the Joes, and then this sort of interesting peek into Zartan's history, but only a relatively small peek. And where this is different is it's covering a much larger span of history. It's trying to focus on all of these different characters, but then also trying to have, you know, all of these, you know, large, significant flashbacks along the way. So it's quite a different approach between those two different stories. One
very focused and, you know, and a deeper story, and one which is a much much broader.
I want to get back to this list of characters. There's Artan, there's his siblings, there's the Rosnians, there's Cobra Commander, Destro and his father, so the Destros.
And the Iron Grenadiers.
There's the Dreadnoks that we know and the Dreadnoks we don't know. There's the Maulers, and then there are some, I think, sort of random, like, thugs and bad guys along the way, and that's a lot. And there's the Chameleon, because, you know, a G.I. Joe story has to have cool and particular vehicles. And I'll make one more comparison here. When IDW was tackling a similar Hasbro brand with lots of characters, a brand where the characters are the vehicles and you want to see both forms, so it ends up being a crowded franchise. IDW published a bunch of one-issue specials for a lot of Transformers characters, and they were all called Spotlights, like Transformers Spotlight Nightbeat, Transformers Spotlight, Thundercracker. All of these were, to a greater or lesser extent, things that might have happened in the then ongoing miniseries or regular series. And almost all of them set up some things that paid off later. And I think that was down to, like, really good writing and editing and sort of confident that they sort of had the time to come back to stuff. And I'm sure those spotlights didn't sell as well, because if you just have, like, Transformers issue 5 and Transformers issue 6, but that month there's also, like, you know, Transformers Spotlight, Six Shot, right? It's like, who's Six Shot? You know, for 10 people out there, that's their favorite Transformer. Like, oh, he's the badassest Decepticon. But it was a way to give these characters 20 pages somewhat to themselves and yet also move the story forward. And I don't think the market would have supported this in 2006. But imagine if there had been, like, G.I. Joe Zartan special, G.I. Joe, you know, Dreadnoks Torch special, Buzzer special, you know, Xandar special. If you could have woven, not this story, but some of this story and some others, or maybe just less of this story, together in a way that lets the spotlight shift, because the spotlight is trying to shift in here, right? Like, I'm invested in Dreadnoks Declassified. I want to know what happens to Xandar and Zarana. And every time we check back in with them, I think, oh, cool, that's where they are. But I'm also really aware that Zartan's the main character of this, and there can only be so many, you know, main characters. Like, every time there's a big G.I. Joe story, it, you know, Hama or Brandon Jurwa or whoever, either it comes down to, like, four or six main Joes doing most of the stuff, and, like, three or four main Cobras doing most of the stuff, or it's one of those stories where everyone, there's like 25 characters and they all each do one little thing, like a real ensemble kind of story. And Dreadnoks Declassified is trying to do both.
Yeah.
Can I shift the conversation to just, I guess, a pivotal scene of the story, which is a recreation from issue 84, which is called... the issue is called Converging Destinies, and it's one of my very, very favorite issues. And when I was getting these issues as originally, I'd be getting them very sporadically. So sort of like from, because you know, it was, I didn't have a local comic book shop. We didn't have G.I. Joe on our newsstands over here. So beyond the Action Force version. So I'd be getting, like, the odd issue from, you know, a holiday or from a mail order catalog or something like that. And so issue 84 was one of the issues that I picked up sort of in isolation, not knowing kind of really the events surrounding it. And I guess partly because of that, I loved it. And I loved the mystery of, like, what's the story that we're being landed in the middle of? And I don't entirely understand it, but I love it. And so a key part of this issue was really expanding the Zartan backstory, and really that this is the up to this point, most of what we knew about Zartan was from this issue. And they within the Dreadnoughts Declassified story, they pretty much recreate almost panel for panel three of the pages from that issue with subtle changes and sort of looking at them side by side. I definitely do prefer the original. I think they're missing some of the subtleties in the original art. It's obviously got the modern glossy colouring, which, you know, mileage may vary on that. But talking almost to Ryan's comment earlier, you know, Zartan here and the other characters very much look like a product of their time. Sort of Zartan with his nice chunky sideburns and all of these kind of things makes you feel like, yeah, this is a period piece. This is set a little bit before where we are now, and it helps sort of I guess sell that as being a flashback. I don't know if you guys had any sort of comments on seeing this being recreated. Yeah,
just that Marshall Rogers is a better artist, and that's a harsh thing to say, but you know, he'd already been drawing comics for 15 years when he did this, and he'd already drawn a celebrated run on Batman.
Right.
This, okay. You know, this issue of G.I. Joe is not his best work, and it might be a rush job. The book in the 80s was trying to find a regular artist in the numbered 80s, not the decade. You know, it's just his anatomy is better, and his storytelling is not flashy. You know, there are a lot of straight on angles here. There's a lot of one point perspective, to borrow a criticism of mine from our Phil Noto Scarlet Declassified episode, and some Tim Seeley comments from all of his issues. But Marshall Rogers can draw a lot better than whoever's on the left here in comparing these two pages.
Ryan, did you have any thoughts about seeing this sequence sort of being recreated?
Yeah, it goes back to, it's just, you can give a nod to the original. You can say, yeah, Larry and, you know, the artist did a great job with this. To me, it's almost like a wasted page, because develop it from here. Like, take that next step. What's the next few windows from here that you would like to see to expand on the original, instead of just recreating what we already know was out there? I prefer the original compared to what was in Declassified.
Fair enough. Probably not too much that we can add to that.
I spy with my little eye.
I wanted to sort of call out a couple of I spies. I'll start with a very obvious one. That was the Iron Grenadiers, an early appearance, and one that we commented just only last week when we were talking, Tim, about the Scarlet Declassified one. It's this same early design, slightly less futuristic.
By early, you mean like retroactively early. Like, this isn't a toy design that didn't get made. This is artists for Devils Do extrapolating backwards from the action figure that did come out. What would they look like 5 years earlier?
So it's an encore appearance for them, and yeah, sort of building out, sort of falling into that temptation to I guess make Zartan's origin story touch the wider world of G.I. Joe, of bringing in Destro, the Iron Grenadiers, Tomax and Zaymot and co, which I guess we talked on a little bit of maybe just making it too broad. But So another I spy that I noticed was Rusnian General Moskin, which was a name that was like tingling in the back of my mind, but it was only looking in the back matter in the trade paperback that made me realize that he was a character that had appeared in Devil's Due previously in issue 17, arc The Cabal.
Oh.
That was kind of very sort of Russian October Guard, etc. So reusing that same name. And this was an interesting one, which I didn't pick up on at the time. I thought the scene was a little bit weird, and I was like, what are they trying to do with this scene? And then again, looking in the back matter, aha, that's what they were doing. So they have that. They had that scene where Zartan meets a girl, and they hang out for a bit, and then he kicks her out in a somewhat uncouth manner. And this was in Chicago, and I thought to myself at the time, that was a bit of a weird sequence. What was that all about? Did you guys figure it out?
Is that where Zanya's conceived?
Yeah. So that's what they're alluding to, that this is Zanya's mother. So it's a Zanya origin story as well, to some degree.
So, like, that's cool. Couldn't we have assumed that at some point between page one of Dreadnoughts Declassified and issue one of Devil's Due G.I. Joe that Zartan slept with a woman and she conceived their child? Like, unless there's some other story, like she's adopted or, you know, like she's a clone, since that woman doesn't come back into the story. And, you know, it does show that he's a cad, but he's also stealing identities and murdering people. So, like, you know, would that page be better spent having him, you know, talk to Torch or something, you know, like I've got a mission for you, or, you know, something like that. And you know, this is, you know, it's like checking a box. I mean, this is checking a box that like really didn't need to be checked. It's like, do you guys remember in all that like cut, I'm making a joke here. Do you guys remember all that cut footage from Star Wars Episode 2 and Episode 3 where like Anakin takes Padme out for a romantic dinner and like the Jedi really don't know that they've got a secret romance and they sleep together? It's like, and then she's pregnant and she's like hiding it. Remember when she's hiding it with her like crazy dresses in Episode 3? It's like, no, I assumed that they had sex and they conceived children because she's pregnant. And everything else about the movie is telling me and showing me that they have that kind of relationship. So I'm glad this is where I reveal the joke. Like, there is no scripted scene. They didn't shoot any scene where he's like, they start kissing and then like it fades to black. It's like, no, they yes, I'm sure if he has a kid, that's because they made the kid.
Again, I completely agree. It's one of those scenes where it's like, okay, how does this progress the story? And you know, he's talking to the gentleman who he's making fun of because he has a Caribbean accent, but it doesn't tell like, you know, what were they were trying to complete. But I get it. You want, oh, this is where Zanya comes in. That's her mother. Okay. What's next? Where are we going from here?
What would be more interesting? Let me ask a different question. How did the two of you feel with the reveal at the end of issue one that there's this person out there with a brown cowl and black makeup on his face named Zartan? And then we don't see him for issue two, I think. And then in issue three, or we don't see him much. Anyway, somewhere in issue two or three, the character that we've been following the whole story, Zartan, whose name we don't know, decides to and then does take that identity. How do you feel about that? Because that's a bold story decision from Blaylock.
Yeah, I think my first reaction was a little bit of confusion because of the flashback nature. I struggled to connect where we were in time in terms of how the original flashback sequence, where we are in inverted commas now, compares to this sequence and all that kind of thing. But beyond that, I was a bit like, hold on, wait, is the character that we've been following up to this point not Zartan?
Yeah, at the end of issue one, that's what I thought. I thought, oh, wait, is this some other guy who we've been following? And like Zartan disappeared from the story and went and started leading the biker gang at some point and has just walked in.
Yeah. So it's a bold choice, but a little bit confusing.
I was in that. I felt the same way, especially after when they were talking about the technology for the chameleon technology. And you see that they bring in the biker gang from Australia. And I'm like, oh, so this is where Zartan gets his powers. And then but then you also know that his brother and sister, so you're like, no, that's Zartan. And then it's, so he took this guy's place and he wanted to do it so that he could take his life. But at the end, he calls Cobra Commander and Cobra Commander knows he's Zartan. And Cobra Commander's tried to kill him already. So I struggled a little bit there. Like, then what was the point for him to take Zartan's life? I guess I thought it was the
heist. Here are my two final thoughts on this story element. Okay, in terms of being able to follow who's who, in Marvel and IDW Hama stories, when we have Snake Eyes flashbacks, Snake Eyes' face is obstructed. He's wearing a hat or sunglasses or their shadows. And I find that's really effective and powerful because it looks forward, right? Like, it's the team saying to us, the reader, no, you don't get to see his face. And also, like, playfully, this is Snake Eyes. You can't see his face in the way that, like, some, like, young Bruce Wayne is walking around and his shadow is kind of shaped like a bat, that kind of thing. What this miniseries, Dreadnoughts Declassified, is missing is some kind of visual marker for Zartan, whether it's like some sort of proto version of his face makeup or like a particular pair of sunglasses, or like he keeps pulling out a photo, like maybe he kept one photo, you know, of his family, like, and every time it's like another flash forward and he's infiltrating some other lab or military base, the Rusnians, you know, he like pulls out this photo and him and his two siblings as kids. And then it regrounds me. And I would think, okay, this is Zartan. And it might be sort of too on the nose if, like, you know, right after he runs away from home, the first scene, he like starts having like a proto version of the makeup on his face, or like wearing a cowl. But whatever it is, it would be clear. And then there wouldn't be confusion at the end of issue one when the sort of other Zartan, like the previously existing Zartan, shows up. And I think it's a big problem if two or three out of three readers read your comic and someone shows up and they say, wait, is this guy that guy? Did he disappear from the story and it's him all along? And, you know, because Zartan like keeps changing his appearance and keeps changing his costumes. And then secondly, I think it's really interesting. And I think I kind of like it on balance that Zartan, this is a place where I feel like thematically Blaylock isn't checking off a box, because there is no reference in the toy file card. It's like Zartan assumed the Zartan identity. Like, oh, here Blaylock's doing it. He's having him assume the Zartan identity. It's a surprise. And it offers something new in a miniseries that doesn't do a lot of that, like new shocking or new really inventive. And the reason why I think on balance I don't like it is that means that whoever this other Zartan is who has been running the Dreadnoughts has this cool look, and that our Zartan... The toy Zartan didn't invent this cool, weird villain look. And that always seemed to, I just assumed, like, I don't know, he's got this cloak and this weird armor because he's awesome. Like, oh, wait, he stole it?
Now I want to read the origin story of that Zartan.
No, exactly. So I think Blaylock takes a big risk here. And I'm sort of okay with either, with you know, some readership thinking, no, that's cool because he's lost himself. And so he like loses himself in this other guy. And here's the final guy, or sort of the most prominent of them, like the Zartan persona, like, interesting, cool. But like, imagine if there's some story where like Storm Shadow, he like goes on some mission and he assassinates some other ninja for his uncles who run the clan. And he's like, I'm going to put on this white costume. And like, it's like, oh, wait, you didn't. Mark, you could counter that Snake Eyes does that in issue 95 when he invents his version 3 costume out of the parts assembled from the three brothers who were like torturing him with the Marinus. But I think that's okay because Snake Eyes already had an established iconic look of like black and, you know, covering his face and certain weapons. But it's like, No, Blaylock. I think in trying to make Zartan more damaged and like relatable, you made him less sort of spicy and special.
There's also a slightly unanswered question, which is why Zartan, in inverted commas, wanted to, or why did, what's he called? At the time he was calling him
Ormery.
Ormery. Why did he spend all of that time sort of ingratiating himself with Zartan and then with that view to becoming Zartan? What was, I don't know if it was quite clear what the motivation was behind that.
Imagine if the Zartan who already existed had like kidnapped Xandar and Zarana, or had brainwashed them, or had, they were in his gang, and he's like, I'm going to rescue my siblings and then reveal that I took out their boss, their father figure. I saved them. Like those three ideas are not good, but they make it more personal. They create some linkage.
Okay, we're running relatively long, so let's maybe wrap it up with a final thought and a score.
Two quick questions, Mark. You're good at words that I don't know. Issue 2, page 3. What's pommy? What's strine?
Pommy would be Australian slang for an Englishman. So they're probably calling Buzzer a pommy something.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. Listen, pommy. Yeah. It's Zartan's Australian and he's insulting Buzzer. What's the other one? Strine.
Yeah.
I don't know if I know that one.
Okay. Well, maybe while I say this sentence aloud, you can be Googling it such that when I finish this sentence, you can just chime in and tell us what it is.
So the only thing I want to add is when Zartan is on the plane being beaten by who I assumed were Crimson Guard, because it was an extensive Enterprise plane.
Hmm.
You have one of the guards reading a James Patterson book, Big Bad Wolf. So to me, I'm looking at him like, why is that in there? What kind of Easter egg is this? And I still couldn't figure out why the artist, whoever penciled that in there, put that. I don't know if it was supposed to help develop the story or not, but I don't know. But there was a number of different Easter eggs, I think. One other one is after he receives the treatment, he starts to fade in and out, and you see the bubbles kind of around him as he's changing. I thought that was a nice nod to, what issue was it? It was the first one with Zartan when he snuck onto the base. Again, though. Tim, bless you, Tim.
48.
It was all about checking boxes, and I have to say that I think talking with you guys, and this is not a bad thing, I think my score actually went down now, because I'm looking at it with a critical eye. So,
see, I was bringing you on here to sort of, you know, bring in the positivity, the good vibes, and lift us all up. But I think we've just poisoned the well and brought you down, Ryan. I feel like we've broken you.
I enjoyed the story. I like Larry Hama is the godfather. He is the George Lucas for G.I. Joe. His story and his main arcs are the baseline, the canon. But I like these kind of offshoot stories for the entertainment purpose. It was a fun little story arc. It made me think of different ways to appreciate, you know, Zartan and to kind of figure out why the Dreadnoks are the way they are. It just opens up more conversation. And that's not a bad thing.
Very good. We're going to have to wrap up. Just to cover off a previous point, Strine is the English language as spoken by Australians, the Australian accent, especially when considered pronounced or uneducated. So when Buzzer's talking about brushing up on his strine, he's talking about brushing up on Australian accent and slang. So as we final furlong for scores and wrap up, I went into this trying to, I remembered reading it back in the day and not really enjoying it, and honestly it being one of my least favorite stories from the Devil's Due era. So I was interested to see what I would make of it on a reread. I did struggle with my first read and felt somewhat dejected
on each subsequent reread, it sort of, the story made more sense to me, and I sort of gave it a little bit more leeway. I like the ambition of it. There's some interesting points, you know, within there. And I think, you know, I won't get away from the fact that the covers are spectacular on these issues. So a nice looking book on the outside. The art on the inside is, you know, it's mixed because of the all of the different artists and inkers and sort of all of the different pencilers, inkers, colorists make it uneven, and you know, some of those are better than others. And overall, I think the story is just a little bit unnecessarily hard to follow with the flashback structure, and possibly just too broad and you know, doesn't conjure up the fun of the story. My favorite Dead Dreadnought stories, such as 84 or any number of the other sort of Dreadnought focused stories that we've seen before. So ultimately, still, you know, not my favorite issues, but I was glad to, you know, have a chance to dig into it and explore what worked and what didn't. So maybe 3.5 out of 10. I'm scoring this one low, but it wasn't my favorite.
Let me go first, because mine might be lower than Ryan's. I'll do this in a sentence. I give this a 3. Ryan.
A ton of promise, a great idea, but it just wasn't executed the way it could have. I will give it a 6 out of 10.
Good. So as I think we're now into the wrap up. So, Ryan, thank you so much for joining us. Great to talk and get your perspective on this series as well. I think there was lots of stuff that you came up that we wouldn't have necessarily come up with by ourselves. So it was great to have you on. Can you remind people where they can find you?
You can find me at the Island of Misfit Toy Collectors on YouTube. I am also Dreadnought Ryan on Instagram. So, you know, just stop by, say hello. I would love to have you guys on sometime on the Island of Misfit Toy Collectors. I love what you guys are doing. I appreciate all the hard work that you guys put in. I learned so much about the comics. Your last interview with Diana Davis was absolutely phenomenal. And I just look forward to every time I see a new episode from you guys. So please keep up the great work. I just can't say enough positive things about what you guys have been doing. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Ryan. Thanks for being on the show. We should say where people can find us, Mark, and I have a special sign-off jingle for this episode.
Okay. I'll say that everyone you can find out more about Talking Joe at our website, which is talkingjoe.co.uk, and that has links to all of the possible things that you could look at, like Facebook, Twitter, I won't say X, Instagram, our voicemail, our Patreon, links to all of the audio only platforms, YouTube, etc. So that's the place to go, talkingjoe.co.uk. Tim, what about you? Where can people find you?
My brick and mortar comic book store in Somerville, Massachusetts is Hub Comics. I'm executive producer of Atomic Abe. Go to youtube.com/AtomicAbe for video essays on TV and film. And I write about G.I. Joe at arealamericanbook.com. Do you want to say thanks to our Patreon backers?
Thank you, as always, to our Patreon backers who find us on patreon.com/talkingjoe. They get early access to content and some exclusive stuff over there as well. So big thanks to Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, and Shane, who are all getting that stuff. Next time on Talking Joe Disavowed, we will continue our side quest away from America's elite before we get to the Mark Powers run. And we will be doing that next time with Special Missions Antarctica, which came out in December 2006. And then we're also covering the issues from Skybound, G.I. Joe, Real American Hero, 301 is in the can, 302 is probably out by the time this happens, and then 303 is obviously the next one after that. So lots of fun seeing the new era of ARAR, as well as Duke and Cobra Commander coming out from Skybound from December. So, Tim, you promised a jingle. I'm on edge of my seat. What's going to happen?
Okay. It's an international podcast. Talking Joe, analyzing comic books each week. Talking Joe, it's Talking Joe. Where's Mark and Tim? I don't know any Mark and Tim. Talking Joe comes from everything you hear. Get it? Here? H-E-A-R?
Finished?
Yeah, that was it.
Okay. Fantastic. Thank you, Tim.
Bye. Thanks, everyone.
Do we get two songs?
No, that was it. That was the sign-off.
All right. Well, nobody beats Talking Joe in the international podcast. Laters.